Higher education is a busy place. Just ask University of Tennessee System President Joe DiPietro or Tennessee Board of Regents Chancellor John Morgan. Together, the two men oversee the state's colleges and universities. This week, I spoke with both of them about the challenges their two systems face, including the balance between academic freedom and political concerns, preventing sexual assault on campus, and the effect that Tennessee Promise may have on the state's community colleges. Our conversation began with a discussion on the financial future of Tennessee higher education.
In order for us to really meet the state's needs, and I think those needs have been pretty clearly articulated by Governor Haslam, and that is that we need to raise education attainment level in Tennessee. Our workforce is undereducated compared to other states and arguably even other developed countries. So if we're going to survive and thrive in a global economy, we're going to have to raise education attainment. In order to do that, you got to have several pieces that come together. One of those pieces is relates to institutions that are capable of providing the services that are needed, but they can only do that to the extent they have the resources necessary to provide those services in an effective way. In our system, we have historically had shared funding responsibility between the public through the form of appropriations and students through the form of tuition and fees that students pay or are paid on their behalf. And if you look over the last 25 to 30 years, 30 years ago, roughly 70% of the cost of an education, post-secondary education, was paid for by the public, about 30 on average, and these are averages, by students. Today, those numbers have just reversed. So it really does call into question the idea that if we need to increase significantly the number of Tennesseans who have post-secondary credentials, and we continue to raise the price in order to provide the resources necessary, is that a sustainable financing mechanism? And I think the answer that we have come to is that no, it really isn't.
No, I would agree. You know, I think the circumstance is that we have transferred the cost of a public education to greater and greater extent to the students and their families. And the sustainability of that model is problematic. And so if you look at access to higher education, the completion agenda that we have in Tennessee, the ability to generate more degrees per unit of time, more post-secondary credentials, we have to figure out how we're going to be different as a business model in this kind of a climate and set of circumstances in which there's a structural deficit in the state's budget. And, you know, if you look at our appropriations particularly, they're no different in TBR with John. Over the last 10 years, as far as the state appropriations go, they've stayed relatively flat, same number 10 years ago as we have today. Yet we're educating 20% more students. We have bigger enrollments at all our places. So we're doing things more effectively and efficiently, but the sustainability of continuing to offset the necessary cost to keep the programs moving forward and being delivered to the backs of students has to change.
So, Chancellor Morgan, then how do you plan to work together as these two systems to address some of these issues?
Well, in very large part, it's by working together to try to tell the story in the way that the story needs to be told, and that is that if we are to achieve the state's goals, we have to come to a conclusion as a state in how to better finance our aspirations when it comes to post-secondary education. And part of that, I think, is making the effort to describe in ways that people will connect with about how critical this really is, and it really is, I believe. I think the governor has made that point over and over and over again. And do that in a way where it gives decision makers and decision shapers the idea that this is a priority. I've been in state government for 36, 37 years. One of the things that I have observed in working with budgets over that period of time is that the things that are priorities get funded. So how do we elevate post-secondary education and the state share of that cost to a level where it becomes the priority or a priority that is dealt with effectively in the budget?
I mean, I think the key here is that we have to be able to change the culture of much of Tennessee to see education collectively, K through 20, frankly. We're obviously parochial to higher education, but in post-secondary work. But, I mean, I think it's a matter of saying if you you no longer have a manufacturing job in your local community that will sustain a family as frequently as they used to. If you do, it's likely it takes more training to do that, at least a technical degree or perhaps even a baccalaureate degree. It's about having the right ability to have the workforce we need to bring the businesses to Tennessee and foster economic development. And if we don't have the right number of degrees produced and we're in a circumstance where we have to continue to pass the cost on to our students, then we get into a circumstance where we may not be able to deliver on the Drive to 55 as effectively or as efficiently.
I'd like to pivot on to some other topics to talk about while I've got the two of you here in the room with us. The topic of sexual assault on college campuses is getting a lot of attention nationally right now. There are some victims and victims' advocacy groups who say that colleges and universities on the national level aren't doing enough to prevent and prosecute incidents of sexual misconduct. Well, back on August 20th, University of Tennessee Knoxville Chancellor Jimmy Cheek issued a letter in which he outlined some of UT's strategies for dealing with sexual assault on campus. Dr. DiPietro, one of the things that Dr. Cheek mentioned in that letter is the Sexual Assault Response Team, or SART. So tell us a little bit about that team and its role in addressing sexual assault on campus here.
So first and foremost, we take the issue of sexual assault very seriously. And so the SART team would be in a position to help a victim out from the standpoint of anybody who indicates that they've been sexually assaulted. We thought it was important to put in place an interim policy as a result of the task force's report, in the White House task force. And we have every reason to think about putting in a permanent policy eventually with our Board of Trustees. Our university code of conduct already had language in it regarding sexual assault and misconduct. And, you know, we take this very seriously, and obviously we want to keep all of our people and all of our students safe. And so it's a mechanism by which somebody who's been in that circumstance can get the kind of help and assistance they need without fear of retribution or other consequences.
And we're, I think you would find on each of our institutions, we have 46 institutions in the board system. 13 of those are community colleges and 6 are universities. Unfortunately, this is an issue that can arise at any institution of any size at any time. But I think we are very focused on this as well. There's a collective conversation going on among our institutions about having the right policies in place, but more importantly, having the right response capabilities in place to be able to successfully help a survivor of an assault to deal with that issue as best we can. While I know there's been a lot of press about schools around the country, not so much the schools in either of our systems, but you know, perhaps not dealing with those issues in a very straightforward way. I don't think that has been a problem for us, and I can pretty well guarantee it's not going to be a problem.
Yeah, I would also add that the SART approach is a way where a student who's in this circumstance can make a report and feel comfortable. These people are approachable, they're professionals, not fear a lack of confidentiality, be open to people coming forward. You know, I mean, I think that's a first step in any community. Then there are educational pieces that eventually be put in place and other things that need to be done. But I think the ability for a student to know, I have this resource if I've had this circumstance. I don't need to be worried about coming forward. And I should be encouraged to do so, are all part of the SART approach.
I would imagine that it's a multi-layered approach as well, because you would have to involve security / campus police, administrators, student organizations, students and faculty themselves, and that UT Knoxville is in the process of revising its sexual assault policies. Can you tell us a little bit about some of that revision and what's going on there?
Well, you know, I think it's always good to look at policy frequently to dust it off and see how we need to improve it. I think we want to be in compliance with all state and federal laws in regards to these kinds of circumstances, and it's an effort to review it carefully with our general counsel's office and make sure we're totally compliant. And we want to be user-friendly, and we also want to be in an environment where people feel they understand their ability to come forward without any fear of doing so.
Well, as a university president and a system chancellor, respectively, part of your job description is defending academic freedom for your students and your faculty. Mm-hmm. But an important part of your job as well is dealing with the legislators who control the purse strings, people who have control over significant chunks of your budget. So Chancellor Morgan, I want to start with you on this one. How do you approach that sometimes very delicate or fraught balance between political concerns and academic freedom, even when those two interests may be diametrically opposed at times?
Well, in our case, Brandon, it has not been a major issue for us, particularly as it relates to academic freedom in terms of activities in the classroom. That's not to say that questions don't come up from time to time. I think we both have been engaged in conversations with the General Assembly over the last several months about student activities and various kinds of things that go on our campuses. And the questions that are raised are not necessarily questions that shouldn't be raised. I mean, the university by its nature and a community college by its nature are places where you want an open exchange of ideas. You want people exploring the boundaries of what they understand. You want people to understand better about other cultures, other individuals, and diversity issues that arise. Doing that in a way where everybody feels like they have the opportunity to fully participate is important, irrespective of a particular ideological position or direction from which they might come. So those questions are legitimate questions to be raised. And so far, I think we've been able to have that kind of conversation with members of the General Assembly. And for the most part, I think it's a conversation that's been healthy, that has led to a much clearer understanding of kind of how things transpire, how we get to where we get to in terms of various of activities on our campuses. And I think that'll continue. I mean, I really think it's sometimes an uncomfortable conversation, but it's not a conversation that shouldn't take place.
Dr. DiPietro, you've had some recent experience with a very specific example
sure.
of this, of course, which is Sex Week, a week-long series of talks and seminars and activities that generally is geared towards sex education and discussions of sex as a cultural issue. But lawmakers in Nashville weren't particularly pleased with that, even to the point of threatening the UT system budget. So when using this as our example, when you approached legislators to talk to them about this, how did you frame these arguments of academic freedom versus...
So it was largely... Well, academic freedom is very, very important in a classroom setting. First off, these are student activities. So while they're educational, they're not traditional classroom activities that are part of a course. We would obviously be disappointed and would stand tall and be opposed to influencing, for example, what a chemistry professor teaches in an organic chemistry class by nature of legislation or intervention by elected officials, okay? So I wanted to be clear about that. When we look at the issue around student activities, it's clear based on precedent that the First Amendment comes into play, freedom of speech in the U.S., which all of us hold dear to our hearts, and that it's really a First Amendment issue. And there have been test cases in which the University of Tennessee's lost. In 1973, we lost a case where I believe Dick Gregory was invited by a student group to campus, as well as Timothy Leary. And the chancellor at the time indicated that those weren't going to happen, and the students involved filed suit, and we lost. And so we have had board policy for more than 35 or 40 years now, which protected the students' right to free speech to have these people on campus and provide their views. So I continued with our lawmakers and other policymakers to help them understand this was a First Amendment issue, that universities need to have these kinds of programs by and large because of the nature of keeping our students safe around their sexuality. And that while some of it was disappointing and perhaps distasteful to some people, others felt it wasn't, and it was their right in a wonderful country like the United States to be able to have those speakers come. So we continue to work through it with the First Amendment at the center of the conversation. We did take the resolution, which was non-binding, what we finally call 626, and adopted policy with our board this year regarding it from the standpoint of opting in for the student activity fees around speakers, and put in place the other stipulations that are in that resolution, too.
This is a question I hadn't written down, but I just thought about as we were talking about it. It has to make your job a little harder, though, as a university president, and you've got different campuses to oversee and all this, and trying to straddle the gulf between these two sides. It had to have been a tough period for you.
Well, you know, it's part of the job. It was challenging at moments. I wouldn't view it as really tough. I think the really most disappointing thing to me was we worked on this for about 3.5 weeks of the session, and we have much bigger issues that we need to be having conversations about, and we alluded to those some earlier. John talked about them. You know, this whole issue of our, and I did too, about our business model and how are we going to survive and what are the issues around the priority on education for the citizens of Tennessee, and better yet, the third leg on the stool of where Tennessee is from the standpoint of moving educational programming forward at the cutting edge nationally, first one being the CCTA, the completion agenda, the second one being the Tennessee Promise. The third one now is to talk about our business model and how you deal with the funding side. So toward the conclusion of the conversation about the student activity fees, I actually mentioned that to a reporter out of Chattanooga, that my biggest frustration is I wished we could have spent the last 3.5, 4 weeks, John and me collectively, talking about the really important issues, and that is the sustainability of this model and how to deal with it.
Chancellor Morgan, this week, students at East Tennessee State University announced plans for a sex week of their own, scheduled for next February. So are you prepared for the possibility that you might have to have these similar conversations if controversy erupts again?
Sure. If we need to have those conversations, we will. And it wouldn't surprise me if we don't, if it doesn't come up in kind of similar context as it did for the university. But, you know, it's interesting, as we talked a moment ago about sexual violence on campuses and the culture around interactions between men and women and so forth, and the things that can happen. One of the reasons that perhaps folks feel like they're in an environment where they can't come forward, can't talk about things openly, is kind of the taboos historically. Well, you know, I can imagine that part of what they would do at ETSU, whether it's called Sex Week or called anything similar to that, would be to try to create campus-wide dialogue about behavior, about what is appropriate, what is inappropriate. What happens when something inappropriate takes place? What should the structure be? And I think those are kind of those are kinds of topics that were dealt with here at Knoxville in those conversations. And as Joe says, yeah, some of it, you know, from my generation, I would look at it and say that's a little bit over the top, or maybe even a lot over the top. But that's not who is in our schools, so we'll deal with it if the issue comes up. But I'm confident that the students at ETSU and our other campuses have been observing what happened here at Knoxville, and will show some consideration and sensitivity to try not to push people's buttons unnecessarily.
You know, I would add this. I think the majority of policymakers understand the need for sexual education on a university campus, and they realize that if we can prevent one unplanned pregnancy, if we can prevent the transmission of a sexual disease, if we can prevent a sexual assault, and we talked about that earlier, it's well worth the time. And we've been doing that collectively in universities, public and privates, for years and years and years. It's the awareness piece that the local SEAT group got into that I think caused the biggest issues with some of our policymakers from the standpoint of content. So, you know, and I actually posted a letter, if you remember, here on campus at Knoxville saying, you know, we defend this issue based on the First Amendment rights that we all have, but it also needs to be conducted in a way that it's aware of not purposefully offending those people who find this offensive. I mean, there are some people who do and some people who don't, and that's a wonderful thing, I guess, about people, because we're all different and our values are different. So just recognize that. Be aware that just because you have the right to do this doesn't mean you should do it in a way that offends a lot of people who might find it offensive.
Well, Dr. DiPietro, it's no secret that the University of Tennessee is under siege, not from a military of foreign origin, but an army of bulldozers and earth movers and cranes and construction equipment. Well, at the start of the semester, of course, things are very busy. We're going to have the football season starting momentarily. So it's a bit of a headache to get around for drivers and pedestrians. So I want to spend some time just talking to you a little bit about this construction effort. It's a big one, probably the biggest, I would imagine, in the university's recent history.
I think it's the biggest that I've Well, I've been here 8 years between the two jobs I've had here. It's the biggest I can recall. In the last 4 years, it's about $1 billion here at Knoxville. It's about $1.3 billion across the system. I would add that the majority of those monies have been generated by the institutions themselves.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting for me because I work here. I'm not a student. Mm-hmm. I'm not faculty, but I do work here at the university. And so I've observed a lot of what, you know, the sights and sounds of construction. So I was curious, why all of this all at once as opposed to building by building or street by street? It all seems to be taking place, multiple projects at once. Well, what's the theory behind
that? Well, I mean, I think to begin with, if you do them simultaneously, there's usually cost of scale that there's advantage on. From the standpoint of site preparation, lay down areas, all the things that the construction people will tell you. So there's advantage there. I think there's been a real purposeful approach by the chancellor and his team to say it's been a long time since we re-upped things, particularly dormitories. I mean, Fred Brown's the first dorm on this campus in, 40 years or thereabouts.
That's about right, yeah.
And, you know, we heard frequently from students and their families who were looking at residence halls that the status of ours wasn't adequate and we needed to improve them. And we had to put up an initial dormitory here in order to be able to redo the other ones because you need the beds. You know, Gibbs Hall going down and a new facility being put up there provides a competitive, equal playing field for the athletic department here at Knoxville in recruiting the best athletes. And I think, I mean, I've had this said by policymakers actually at the Building Commission when we were talking about approval of the renovations to Presidential Court and the redo of that area, that, you know, honor students care about the rooms they stay in and the kind of facilities we have for them on campus when they look at their various alternatives, too. And, you know, we're at a move here at Knoxville to continue to charge forward with increasing the academic standards of our entering class. And so it's important to do those kinds of things.
And I would just say, you know, we aspire to have the kinds of problems that they have here in Knoxville, but it really does matter in terms of, as Joe was just saying, in terms of student engagement, having the right facilities, having those facilities configured in a way that really allows students to come together in communities. We know that students who are part of a cohort do better than those who aren't. And a lot of that has to do with physical facilities, is creating an environment within which students can interact and in some cases have to interact. So it's not just about recruiting athletes. It's not just about, you know, nice places. It really is creating a physical environment within which the institution can be successful in student success.
Well, we'll go from Dr. DiPietro's problems to the ones you do have, mm-hmm. and that's coming up under Governor Bill Haslam's Tennessee Promise legislation, which we've alluded to mm-hmm. at several points in this conversation, has a goal of making two-year college and technical college more attainable for graduating high school seniors to the extent that that education of a community or technical college would be largely free. So that falls under your jurisdiction, under
sure.
the Tennessee Board of Regents. If we're talking about potentially a large influx of students, what changes do you think might be necessary to get your facilities, and when I say facilities, not just buildings, but people infrastructure as well, faculty and things like that,
sure.
up to speed to take advantage of this new legislation?
It will cut differently across various institutions in various parts of the state. But generally, from a physical capacity standpoint in our community colleges, we can, as a system, absorb a pretty significant increase in enrollment. If you look back at our enrollments, I guess, 4 or 5 years ago, there were several thousand more students enrolled in community colleges than there are today. A lot of reasons for that, the biggest one being the business cycle. Our enrollment is really countercyclical, so as the economy improves, enrollment goes down, particularly at community colleges. But we have room in most of our cases. Now, Pellissippi, on the main campus in Pellissippi, yeah, we're pretty pressed for space. But we now have Strawberry Plains that has opened and has a great deal of expansion space capability. So physically, I don't think we'll have a problem. In terms of services, configuring classrooms with faculty and meeting the needs of students with student support and other kinds of student services, yeah, that's something of a challenge. It's particularly a challenge in an environment where the funding formula was not fully funded, but we will you know, figure out how to do that. That's part of the business model sustainability question that we really do have to deal with. But we think we'll be ready certainly by next fall for the Tennessee Achieve students, for the Tennessee Promise students who will present themselves to us. And we think over time that will be represent somewhere between 5,000 and 6,000 new students that would not have otherwise come to our institutions but for Tennessee Promise. And that's a big deal. I mean, that's a great thing that initially there will be some small dislocation, we think, in terms of enrollment patterns. But over time, everybody benefits, both in terms of Tennessee's economy, but also our four-year institutions ultimately will benefit from having a better prepared pipeline of students coming in to finish their degrees.
I want to gather some final thoughts here before we let the two of you go. We talked about Tennessee Promise, the constant tug of war with the legislature over funding, rising tuition costs, construction, all of these concerns. So in your view, and I'm sure the two of you do spend a lot of time thinking about this in your roles, what are the biggest challenges? And challenge doesn't necessarily mean a negative thing, but just a big challenge that you see that'll be dominating the way you do your job over the next 5 to 10 years, say. Mm-hmm. And we'll start with you, Dr. DiPietro.
Well, I think I mentioned earlier, I think one of the biggest challenges is the sustainability of our model from the standpoint of the tuition increases that largely have offset the other issue, which is the lack of increase in state appropriations. We have about the same appropriation today as we did 10 years ago from the standpoint of state appropriations across the system. So, I mean, that's a big thing to deal with. We've run numbers. We can look at what we call a 330 model, in which you put in place a 3% tuition increase maximum, a 3% inflationary rate, and 0% if that would happen from the standpoint of state appropriation increases over the next 10 years, and we'd be more than $160 million the wrong direction. So we have to look at ways to be more effective and efficient, more entrepreneurial, to drive revenue in to help solve this problem. At the same time, we have to increase the sense of urgency across the state about education in general, but particularly in our case, post-secondary. That means we need to figure out a way to make people realize the benefits of what we do as an enterprise and what the benefit of getting a post-secondary credential is for a person and their ability, their earning power over their lifetime, the kind of life they can live, and the ability to have great careers. And in a marketplace where more and more as we move to 2025 and beyond, more and more it's going to take a baccalaureate degree or a technical degree or an associate's degree to be able to get a good job. So those are the kinds of challenges that we're looking forward to facing. They're not easy ones, but I think they're good ones to have. And I'm confident with our team and with John's help, we're very much in this together, that we'll figure it out.
Yeah, and I would echo everything that that Joe just said. And for us also, I think a challenge is, and maybe one of the bright spots is that our K-12 system, our P-12 system, really has gotten some good news recently in terms of NAEP scores, in terms of ACT scores. Common Core, while politically there's issues about Common Core, fundamentally it really is the right thing for the state to do so that students who present to us are prepared to go to college. Right now, 70% or so are not really ready for college work. So for us to meet the overall challenge that the state has given us of raising education attainment, really the whole system, P through 20, is critical that we continue the very important reforms and activities that we've undertaken.
Joe DiPietro is in his fourth year as president of the University of Tennessee system. John Morgan will mark his fourth anniversary as chancellor of the Tennessee Board of Regents in October. Gentlemen, thank you for taking the time to talk with me today.
Thank you. Appreciate the time.